America, walk on by your schools that do not teach. Mr. America, walk on by the minds that won't be reached. Mr. America, try to hide the emptiness that's you inside. But once you find that the way you lied and all the corny tricks you tried will not forestall the rising tide of hungry freaks, Daddy. Left behind of the great society. America, walk on by your supermarket dream. Mr. America, walk on by the liquor store supreme. Mr. America, try to hide the product of your savage pride, the useful minds that it denied. The day you shrugged and stepped aside, you saw their clothes and then you cried, those hungry freaks, Daddy. They won't go for no more great Midwestern hardware store, philosophy that turns away from those who aren't afraid to say what's on their minds. The left behind of the great society.
Okay, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm Radio for Open Ears. This is the newest installment of Reading is Fundamental. That is my monthly show all about books, about music. My name is Sal Cataldi. I am a music writer for Pop Matters and the New York Times sometimes, and Inside Out, Upstate New York, and New York State Music. And I'm also a local musician with a band called Spaghetti Easter Music, Space Heater, Vapor Vespers, etc., etc. But today we're here to talk about a book about the fantastic Tom Wilson. He is an underrated record producer, if there ever was one. He started a label out of college. He's a young black man who went to Harvard and started Transition record label for a couple of years, and he recorded the first recordings of Sun Ra, Cecil Taylor, early John Coltrane, a bunch of folks. He then went on to Columbia Records, where he produced really the breakthrough recordings of Bob Dylan. He's the guy who made him go electric. He actually created the electric version of Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence. Then he went on to Verve Records, where he discovered and recorded the debuts of people like Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention and the Velvet Underground. We're here with Richie Untenberger, who is one of the top rock scribes, written some of my favorite books about rock. He wrote one of the essays in this book about Tom Wilson. So without further ado, here's Richie, and we're going to talk about the great Tom Wilson. Okay, here we are, next edition of Reading is Fundamental. We're here at one of the great, 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 great rock writers, scribes,
Richie Utzenberger, who has been a part of a new book, which is all about the famous producer Tom, the not famous enough producer Tom Wilson, who is responsible for a lot of Dylan, Zappa, and a bunch of other bands. So I want to welcome you and have you sort of introduce yourself and brag a bit about all the great books you've done and the new book, which I know you just finished, which is going to be coming out next year, I believe.
Yeah, I'm a rock historian and author, and I've written about 15 books. Most of them have been about rock music history. And you've mentioned, well, we will mention a few of them. My first book was Unknown Legends of Rock and Roll, about 60 of the greatest, quote, cult rock artists. My next one was Urban Spacemen and Wayfaring Strangers, which had more in-depth chapters about the most overlooked acts of the 1960s. I also did an extensive two-part history of 1960s folk rock, which I combined into one ebook with more material called Jingle Jangle Morning. I've also done a book on The Who when they tried to follow up Tommy with their Lifehouse opera, which didn't get finished, but they did finish their Quadrophenia opera. And although I have done a book about the Velvet Underground that came out 16 years ago, that's been out of print for almost 10 years. And that was in the day-by-day reference format, what happened in the notable days when they were active. And in the 15 or so years since that book came out, I learned a lot more about the group and did some more research. And my next book, which is called Do What You Fear Most, The History of the Velvet Underground. That is a standard narrative biography, which will be very long, which will have a lot of that new information as well as the information I learned when I did my first book.
But
And that is coming out supposedly spring 2026 on Omnibus Press. That's a London publisher, but it's going to be available in the United States too.
yeah, that's a great publisher. I do a lot of I specialize in doing all these reviews of books about music, and they send me a lot of stuff, and they're a great publisher. So let's start with the book. Interesting enough, Tom Wilson, a famous, I mean, an American producer who was involved in so much great stuff, from avant-garde jazz to pioneering folk rock music and so on, who is kind of not in the position of George Martin or other famous producers from the 60s. This, I believe, is the first biography of him. It's not a formal biography, it is a collection of essays. It's published by a Paris publisher, which is very interesting. Editions 1989, and it's a collection of essays. Yours is actually the biggest essay, I believe, in the book. It's 75 pages of fresh material, and you really deal about his career at Columbia Records. So that was with Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel, and so on and so forth. But let's talk about where he came from. He's a guy from Texas, Waco, Texas, black man. Ends up in Harvard, ends up starting a jazz label on some borrowed money. So if you can just give us a little preamble to, his early life and how he ended up at Harvard and doing the label.
Aside from his musical work, I think he was a pioneer as an African American working in the entertainment business. Having that credential in the 1950s, a Harvard graduate for an African American was itself very unusual. But although there were a lot of African Americans being recorded since the dawn of the record business, there weren't very many African American executives. And there were some, of course, black-owned record labels, but Tom Wilson was an innovator in, as you mentioned, starting working at a jazz record label and also being very adventurous in who he was recording. Not everything he recorded was what would have been considered cutting-edge jazz in the 50s and early 60s, but artists, excuse me, like Sun Ra and Cecil Taylor, they were on the periphery of what was becoming free jazz. And it indicates to me that Tom Wilson, although he wanted to be successful and sell records like virtually everybody does, working as a producer or an executive in the record business, he wanted to do so at least some or much of the time with music that he considered groundbreaking and significant. And I think this might lead into some of your next questions. That is a reason that even though he didn't have a background in folk and then later rap music, he saw that those musics were changing and offering a lot of not just musical but social importance, and felt that he could be a contributor in those fields too.
Yeah, so his just to kind of quickly run through this, he's at Harvard. He's a member of the Young Republican Society, and he is a member of the Jazz Society, or a founding member. And then he has this dream of starting a jazz label. And actually, if he had money, and a girlfriend of a friend of his lends him $970, and he creates a Transition label. And that label did, like you said, it had the in 1956, it was the debut recordings of Sun Ra, which was Jazz by Sun Ra, Cecil Taylor, Jazz Advance, Donald Byrd. And they did about 15, I believe they did about 15 releases over the 2 years that he was there. And then he continued to work in the jazz field when he moved on to, I believe, United Artists and Savoy, continuing to work with Sun Ra, Taylor, Herbie Mann. Now, the thing that I love the most is, or that I did not know about, is this Roz Chaney album. I don't know if you, this wasn't your section of the book, but he hired the Sun Ra Band so they could eat to back a woman who was a limbo singer. And it's an album of limbo tracks called How Low Can You Go? But let's move into your section of the book, because that really is the most, probably the best known and most commercially successful era is. So how did he get to Columbia Records? And then how did he end up inheriting the production of Bob Dylan?
It seemed to be kind of a fluke. Columbia was impressed by a speech he gave at an industry convention. And a lot of what happens in rock history is due to chance that works out really well that could have never been planned according to like how to succeed in the music business world guide or something like that. I think a lot of it was to do not so much with Tom Wilson, he's going to be the best producer for Bob Dylan, as politics at Columbia Records, where there were these tensions between Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, who was becoming one of the most powerful managers in music in the early 60s, and John Hammond, who signed Dylan to Columbia Records and was already, although he was middle-aged, he was already a figure of great repute in the music business for working with a lot of jazz stars, especially. He also signed Aretha Franklin, although they didn't develop Franklin that well at Columbia Records. And when, for political reasons, it seems like Grossman especially wanted John Hammond replaced, they didn't, I don't think Grossman or Columbia had somebody like, Paul Rothchild, he's a really promising young folk producer, which he was. This is way before the Doors. Let's get him on board. It was more like, well, this guy seems to have a good attitude, and maybe it's somebody that Dylan can relate to, which would be very important at a time when Dylan wasn't a star yet. And Tom Wilson admitted he didn't know folk music well, or even have an especial affinity, but when he heard Dylan, he felt like the lyrics especially were saying something that was important. And the way Tom Wilson told it, it wasn't even so much like, well, let's see if you and Bob get along. It was more like, well, you're going to be working with Dylan and go to it. So those things can be disastrous. With the Velvet Underground, once when MGM tried to assign them a producer, after 3 days, the producer left and by mutual agreement. But it turned out that it was, at least for 2 or 3 years, a good combination. In part because, and I'll probably re be returning to this point, Tom Wilson so wasn't a producer in the way that a lot of people think of as producers, where they're like, the producer has an idea. I have all these things to mix. I have a special way to get a sound. It was more like his asset was, I can identify someone who's really talented and let them do what they want to be doing and not interfere with that and get the best out of who they actually are rather than guide them to, well, why don't you put this in or why don't you sing this way?
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it was in your section, but there was something where it says he called folk music music for dumb guys. Was that in yours?
Yeah,
Yeah, that was.
it was a quote in there.
Yeah. And then he started the work. He was first involved in 63 in the Freewheeling album, a few tracks on that.
Yeah.
And then he, what did he do after that? I mean, until his final job, which was his most commercially successful job for Dylan, like a Rolling
Yeah.
Stone, right? So what albums was he involved in and tracks and
He produced three entire albums, Dylan's third album, Times They Are Changing, and his fourth album, Another Side of Bob Dylan, his fifth album, which was very crucial, bringing it all back home because half of that was rock music. That was the transition from Dylan from to folk to rock. And the Like a Rolling Stone single, we'll probably get to this in a bit, but it's ironic. Like you said, that was his biggest commercial success, not just with Dylan, but ever, except for The Sound of Silence with Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
But that was his last session with Bob Dylan. Again, probably for political reasons. Also, just to go back to Freewheelin',
Sure.
his second album, he was important because he did a few of the songs on Freewheelin', but it was at the time when I think Columbia's position after Dylan's first album was, well, we might want to drop Bob Dylan because the album doesn't sell well and it's not, people, a lot of people don't like his voice and he's not going to be selling even like Pete Seeger, who did record for Columbia around that time. But then Peter, Paul, and Mary had a huge hit with Blowin' in the Wind, and it
Right.
was realized, even if Bob Dylan himself didn't sell a lot of records, which of course he would, but he wasn't at that point, as a songwriter, he's going to attract attention inevitably, people who want to hear the original versions, and he's going to come up with more songs
Right.
that even if he doesn't have the hits, other people will. So it was important for them to finish that album, which had a somewhat troubled production because John Hammond was replaced. And they wanted to make sure to finish it in time where Blowin' in the Wind, which was Dylan's version was on the second album, was fresh in people's minds and to keep some and to build some momentum for Bob Dylan just at the time when Dylan as a songwriter was becoming known.
Right. And then you talk in there about what I was gonna say. Oh, it just slipped my mind what I was gonna ask you about. So that was yeah, that was his last job. Oh, a lot of the conflict I think you say in the book ended up because Dylan had a habit of kind of singing off mic, like I'm
Yeah.
doing right now. So that seems to be one of the reasons I think that you had mentioned that they may have he may have decided against him in the end,
Yeah.
right?
And I think it wasn't so much like, oh, I want to sing my own way, and Wilson is trying to get me to sing another way. I think as Dylan gained a lot of confidence, he was starting to sell records. He was getting acknowledged even before moving into rock as the most popular folk performer. Not just in North America, but in certainly the United Kingdom and some other parts of the world, he was thinking, I don't really want people to tell me what to do.
Right.
It wasn't, I think, only because Tom Wilson specifically was criticizing or trying to modify his vocal technique. The same thing happened in a way with, there are many examples with the Beatles when they started recording with George Martin, which would be around the same time that Tom Wilson started recording with Bob Dylan.
Right, I
George
see.
Martin was kind of like, well, lads, you do this and you do this. He let them be their best, but he was the guy kind of controlling the mix, adding certain things. But as time went on, and the Beatles were the biggest group in the world, they were be able to say, well, we want to be doing this. And eventually, and George Martin said this, they were kind of telling me what to do, and I was learning from them.
Right.
It's a little unfortunate that the Wilson Dylan dynamic didn't get to that point where it was more like, well, we're both creating and we both respect each other. Dylan didn't do badly with his subsequent producer, Bob
Right,
Johnston. I don't think that at
no, not at
all.
all.
But Tom Wilson, having invested a lot of effort into Dylan's productions, he got a little bit shafted just getting replaced for the same sort of political reasons that enabled him to start working with Bob
Well,
Dylan. But we'll get to that, I think.
I just had a friend was visiting my, I don't know if we had discussed this. I live in West Saugerties, so I'm like a quarter of a mile from Big Pink. And I had a friend come up here, and we actually were at Albert's grave like 2 days
Oh,
ago.
wow.
He's buried behind the Bearsville complex. Actually, there's a
Okay.
little area there. So, you can either go there and say thank you or go there and say, at any rate. So then let's move on to Simon and Garfunkel. So obviously, probably his great, like you said, his greatest commercial success and something that he was really responsible for, not wholly, but in a big way, was the success of Sounds of Silence, the remix. So let's tell us about his work with Simon and Garfunkel, and then how that came about, that folk version of it, electric.
It's another sort of very fortuitous circumstance that Wilson even got involved with Simon and Garfunkel, because Paul Simon was trying to get some of his songs recorded by another act, a really forgotten one that Wilson produced at Columbia, a folk act. But Wilson, to his credit, felt like, well, you and Garfunkel, who adds good harmonies, you're good enough for me to record you doing these songs. And that became their first album, which is a folk album. There are no electric instruments. Wednesday morning at 3 a.m. And it didn't do so well. And Simon and Garfunkel split up. There wasn't, at that point, it might be hard to believe now, at
Right.
that point, it wasn't rancorous. Garfunkel went back to school, and Paul Simon went to England to try and make it as a solo artist, and actually put out an album there,
Right, the
which was still
Samba.
a folk album. But when folk rock really boomed, spring, summer of 1965, not just with Dylan going into rock music, but also the Byrds having a number one hit with a Dylan song,
Right.
that is where I think is really the most important recording by far, starting the folk rock trend, Mr. Tambourine Man. Wilson was realizing, well, this song especially is a standout on this folk album. And if I add electric instruments, then it has a chance of being a hit record. He was absolutely right. It was a little contrived because Simon was in England and didn't really know what Wilson's plans were, though Garfunkel apparently did. I guess the way to do this with the most integrity would have been to get Simon and Garfunkel back in the studio and do a remake, a folk rock remake, if they agreed to that. But what Wilson did was he had session musicians add electric instruments and drums. And the story's been told quite often if you know a lot about Paul Simon. Simon was still in England, or some stories say he was based in England, but he was doing some gigs like in Holland. And he picked up a copy of a trade magazine, whether it's Cashbox or Billboard. And he said, like, he saw, like, With a Bullet, Sounds of Silence at number 79. Obviously, going to be a hit record if they didn't know if it was going to go to number one, but it was a really hot record. And Simon very quickly came back to the United States and reunited with Art Garfunkel. That might seem cynical. I'm going to capitalize on this, but I don't think so. I think that was the reason he came back, but he realized, well, this is the way music is going anyway, and I can do this really well with Art Garfunkel. Then I can, after almost 10 years in the music business, become
Right.
not just a star, but a really significant figure.
Now, did that was that post like a Rolling Stone?
It was.
Or was it pre?
It was around the same time, and I think it was maybe just a bit later. Session dates aren't as exact for Simon and Garfunkel sessions, especially because it wasn't the original session, it was overdubs. So, and Wilson knew this might work because to go back to Bob Dylan, before bringing it all back home, he took recording from Bob Dylan's first album, Dylan's version of House of the Rising Sun, which was a folk version. This is December 1964, and used session musicians to overdub electric instruments on back of it just to see how it might work. That version has never come out on an official CD or LP, but it came out on a CD-ROM. So it's out there. And it's clumsy. It's not like Sound of Silence. But I think Wilson was doing this experimentally and feeling like, well, if we do this more precisely the right way, it's going to be a combination that's really exciting. So that sort of formula, take a folk song, add electric instruments, he was already familiar with. In a way, he was familiar with that from his work on Bringing It All Back Home, because some of the songs on the folk side, he did actually try with electric instruments. And realized, well, maybe at least for now, the folk version is better. But he was already experienced with an artist who was folk moving him to rock with
How
Bob
much
Dylan in early '65.
did he do with Simon and Garfunkel? How many albums did he just
It was
do with
just that
them?
one album and the Sound of
And that
Silence
was it.
electric version. I think that he would have liked to continue working with them, but that was around the time he left. When Sound of Silence was becoming a hit was the time he left Columbia for MGM Records.
Yeah, that was an interesting quote. But now he, according to you, he was the one who put together Al Kooper with the Blues Project. Is that true?
It seems to be
Yeah.
more or less. Remember that Al Kooper already knew Tom Wilson pretty well.
Right.
They just became friends around maybe late '64, early '65. Al Kooper looking for session work and trying to get a rung up in the record industry, but they just hit it off as friends. So Cooper would kind of hang out in his office and listen to stuff. And Cooper is on like a Rolling Stone. He plays a very
Yeah.
important part as the
Right.
organ player. And that whole story, which has been told a lot,
Yeah,
not
yeah,
even among Dylan fans, that he wasn't even supposed to be on the session.
yeah.
He was just supposed to hang out with Tom Wilson as a friend and see what was going on. And he
And he
wanted to
said,
play guitar. But when he heard Mike Bloomfield warming up, he was like, there's no way I'm going to play as good as Bloomfield. But he saw that there was an organ that wasn't being used, and he sneaked over there and turned it on. And Wilson said, what are you doing there? You're not supposed to be there. And he realized, well, it's maybe going to be more disruptive to have an argument with Al Kooper and interrupt the flow of the session. So he let Cooper play. And I don't know if you're going to ask about this. We can get back to Simon and Garfunkel. But that's been cited as a reason that maybe Dylan was getting less happy with Tom Wilson because they did a take of Like a Rolling Stone with Al Kooper on the organ and they heard a playback. And Dylan said, I like that organ. Turn it up in the mix. And Wilson said, maybe this is something he would have liked to have taken back. He said, that guy's not even an organ player. Kind of like insinuating, well, that's, just something that maybe shouldn't even be in there at all. And Dylan supposedly say, don't tell me who's an organ player and who isn't. I like it. I want it turned up. So maybe maybe Dylan said something to Albert Grossman, like, well, sometimes Tom Wilson, I have a hard time getting him listening to me. And Al Grossman, who didn't like people having control over Dylan's career more than he did anyway, wanted Tom Wilson out.
So ultimately, he leaves Columbia, and what's the reason he leaves Columbia, and where does he go to after that? Wilson.
I think it was, as an aside, it's too bad that Wilson wasn't interviewed more. He died fairly young
Right,
when he was
47.
like around 50 in the late 70s. And there are a few interviews, at least stories where he's quoted, and there's one interview where there's a transcript in the book.
It's unbelievable, yeah.
And as a historian, it's the kind of thing, I don't want to sound immodest, but it's the kind of thing, I wish I had been there because there's all these questions that people are really curious about, and some of the questions which were actually posed to him were pretty superficial. But I'm not sure what the terms were of the offer of MGM, but I think it was more like, well, this is a better deal at MGM than I have at Columbia, maybe financially, but maybe also in terms of the power that I have at MGM, not only being able to produce acts, but being able, maybe having more of a voice in signing acts.
Right, which he
The
did.
two really famous acts that he signed there, which are covered in a different chapters in
Right.
the book, of course, were The Velvet Underground and The Mothers of Invention.
Right.
And he didn't
So,
stay at MGM for that long, just a
yeah.
couple of years.
So he did at MGM, he did the first three. Let's start with Zappa and then we'll go into VU. But he did the first three Zappa albums. And basically, again, like you say, even more so than with Dylan, I guess he was pretty hands off, it sounds like, from some of the quotes in the book, that he was reading the Wall Street Journal, he was on the phone, and he had a blonde on his lap, and he would just say, like, turn up the compression, So he was a little more hands off because Zappa was very hands on. So he did those first three albums. He signed them, and worked with Zappa on those first three albums. And then let's get to the VU, since that's really your specific expertise here. So he signs them, and how does he get involved in the way of production with them?
The Velvet Underground, you mean?
Yes.
Sure. There are some different accounts. This is going a little before the official history of the Velvet Underground as the recording arc starts. But there are letters that John Cale from the Velvets wrote to someone he knew in Britain in December 65, which said, "We're doing demos for Tom, we're doing, or like at least a tape for Tom Wilson." But they didn't sign to MGM until May 1966. And the way history often told it was that the Velvet Underground recorded most of their first album in April 1966. Very famous album, of course. It's called the Banana Album. And they took an acetate of those tapes to Columbia Records. This is after Tom Wilson had left, however. It's like 4 or 5 months after he had left. And Columbia turned them down. The reason they went to Columbia was because a guy who co-financed the sessions and was involved in the production, Norman Duff, worked at Columbia Records. Columbia was not interested at all. This is according to Norman Duff. Sterling Morrison, guitarist with the Velvet Underground, reported that then we went to Atlantic and Elektra, and they turned us down, and then Tom Wilson signed us. I think that narrative is improbable chronologically because Norman Duff would have gone to Columbia around April 25th. I know I'm getting kind of exact, but I think it's important to establish
No, great.
chronology. Very quickly got a rejection, but the date on the Velvet Underground contract is May 2nd. To then go to Atlantic and Elektra and get rejected and then get signed by Tom Wilson, it seems improbably fast to me. I think possibly they already knew Tom Wilson or knew of him, thought that maybe he can sign us, and maybe he had expressed some casual interest, but maybe they figured those other labels would be better than MGM or they could get more money out of those labels. And when they got all those rejections, although Jack Holzman of Elektra does not remember being approached with the Velvet Underground, and he has a pretty good memory for who he was considering, then they went to Tom Wilson. And Tom Wilson signed them, not for a huge advance, but it wasn't that uncommon in those days, $3,000. Paul Morrissey, who was involved in their management with Andy Warhol, he very strongly contested to me and others that they were only signed because of Nico, who
Yeah,
only
that's what
sings
you
on.
say in the book. Yeah, that they wanted the Teutonic goddess.
That, and although she only sings three songs on the first album, they're all very important songs. What he was looking at was, well, he knew it wasn't a very commercial group for 1966, but that she was the most commercial part of it in terms of her voice compared to Lou Reed's, the main singer, but also her visual image.
Right. And she had had a pre career there in England with Jimmy Page and those
Only one
kind
single, though, so I
of.
don't think that would have, I'm not sure Tom Wilson would have known about that or known very much about it.
Well, I would suspect with Lou Reed being Lou Reed, that the fact that, oh, I'm going to be working with Bob Dylan's producer might have had a play in
He did
him. Did he like
one.
Dylan? I mean, he must have respected Dylan, Lou Reed.
He went back and forth.
Oh,
Sometimes
okay.
he really put him down, and sometimes it's, but it's in my research, I got quotes from a couple guys who were at Syracuse University with Lou Reed, who went to see Bob Dylan when Dylan played Syracuse in late '63, and said that we all liked that first Dylan album, and Lou Reed could play like Bob Dylan, and we learned some songs off of that. So Reed might have just wanted to deny that because that would have made him seem less original. Not that he needed to do that, because Lou Reed's very original. But somebody who worked with the Velvets as far as booking them into some gigs at the time told me that they were excited to be working with Tom Wilson because he wasn't a name known to the general public like Phil Spector and George Martin, to a lesser degree, was. But within the music business, he was very well known for those successes with Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel.
Right, and he also worked at MGM, and he was very close, it seems, personally with Eric Burdon. So this is when the Animals kind of went psychedelic. He
Psychedelic.
brought that Baroque folk flavor to what they were doing. The
And it's interesting that Wilson's MGM work is known now chiefly for Frank Zappa with the Mothers and the Velvet Underground. But the records he did at MGM that at the time sold by far the most were the Animals.
Right.
Over time, I think certainly the Banana album sold more than anything that he worked with at MGM, and the three first Mothers albums, which, although I didn't write about them, I know a lot about them and I like those records. Over time, they sold pretty well.
Yeah.
I would
And
say over time, both the Velvet Underground and the Mothers records have sold a lot more than the Animals MGM things. But at the
right.
time, 66, 667, the Animals were selling a
And
great
then
deal more.
he also did, you know, as you said, with Nico being the draw possibly for them signing the Velvets, he did the Nico album, which she
Yes.
kind of
And
didn't like. She didn't
she, yeah,
like
she
his
put it
treatment.
down a lot. I really liked the
I
record,
love it.
including the guy who was most, I think, responsible for the sound wasn't Tom Wilson, but the arranger, Larry Fallon, who was responsible for a lot of the orchestration, the strings, the flute really annoyed Nico, especially. I think they're pretty good. Lou Reed had an interesting quote, which in hindsight is pretty apt. He said, "What they should have done is let us play more on the record," because Reed and Cale, on some of the songs, they're playing guitar. So is Sterling Morrison, and let John Cale arrange it. That would have made total sense because Cale went on to be the arranger and producer of most of Nico's records. But I think it worked pretty well. I know Nico didn't like it, of course.
And then I think in your in the book, it also mentions that both John Cale and Dylan, to some extent, say that they never had as good a producer as Tom Wilson. So that speaks volumes.
Yeah, although it took a long time for Dylan to say that.
Well, he was gone. He didn't get to hear it by that time.
Yeah, it was many, many years later. I think at that time, Dylan had a perspective he would not have had, like in the late 60s, if they had said, "Well, what do you think of the Tom Wilson stuff?" He might have said, "Well, Bob Johnston is cooler. Bob Johnston's the guy who produced Dylan the
Right,
rest of the
Michelle.
60s."
Yeah.
And we had some arguments in the studio, but with perspective, having worked with a lot of producers since then and then trying to produce himself, he might have realized, well, at the time I might have been frustrated for certain reasons, but looking back, it was a blend with some tension that was getting the best results.
Yeah. So then after, you know, after MGM, he goes out on his own. He I believe he became a partner for a while in the record plant. He founded a production company, a talent. He was somehow involved with Motown. And then unfortunately, he passes away at the age of 47. So what can we deduce from the latter part of his career?
I know it's not covered much in the book. It's a bit of a mystery to me that after he left MGM, which was the very beginning of 1968, not long after he had finished producing the Velvet Underground second album, and also We're Only in It for the Money, which is a great record by the Mothers of Invention. As significant as the records had been that he had produced before that, I don't think he did anything as a producer significant after 1967. And I don't want to be too harsh. I'm not only saying it wasn't as significant, but nothing really notable. There are some records here and there that are sort of psychedelic, and oh, I should correct myself. There is one good record he did, the Soft Machines first album.
Oh yeah, that's unbelievable to me. I didn't really realize that at all until I read this. And then the book ends again. I think it's about four or five different essays. Yours is the longest that I believe. It has a 1968 New York Times Sunday Magazine article about him, kind of a day in the life, where he you know travels around New York City. He's in the studio. It. You know, sort of following him around. So, what I wanted to find out is how did you become involved with this project with the Editions 1989 folks?
The publisher, as you mentioned, is based in Paris and run by a French woman. And although they haven't published many books, they are interested in aspects of African American culture which haven't been documented with full justice. And she approached me a couple of years ago or so and explained the project that she was doing, and that it wasn't going to be a conventional biography. That would have been hard to do, in part because he died young without being interviewed too much, but that there would be separate chapters. And I didn't want to do the Velvet Underground chapter because that would have overlapped too much with the books that I was doing. So, but I explained that I know a lot about Wilson's folk rock activities, especially because I wrote the two-volume history of 1960s folk rock. And she selected the other contributors on the basis of their fields of expertise. So, although I know a lot about the MGM era, not just the Velvet Underground, but the Mothers of Invention, and those were covered by different authors, I don't know so much about his jazz productions. That, again,
Well,
is
I think,
handled by someone
yeah, and
else.
it was a short stint, although it was very significant in terms of what he, the people that he actually gave the chance to sort of debut. Before we go, I want to, you know, we're wrapping up on Wilson. I want to go to these. I have to say, these are. I got these when they came out, 1989. I believe the second one was 1988,
1998.
1998, right?
Okay.
And 19, 2000. This one was
Yeah,
2000, I guess.
2000 was the
Yeah,
other one.
these are fantastic. And I should tell people, if you can get these, get them. I don't know if it still has the new issues, have the CD in the back, but these are really incredible, incredible collections. That, as you could see, I've spilled coffee on them. There you go. That shows it's a well-loved book, I'm telling you. So tell us a little bit about these two books, and you know, they're sort of really the sort of the Bibles of sort of fringe music in across a number of genres, but largely rock.
Yeah. I also want to say before I answer that question that although the books have been physically out of print for a long time, it's been more than 25 years now. They are available as ebooks. I have the rights to the material. I know not everybody likes ebooks, but they're available with some extra material. Not so much Urban Spacemen, but Unknown Legends. There's quite a bit. There's 15 additional chapters, and also
There
some of the chapters.
like a
I'm sorry?
playlist too? Is there like a playlist, like a comp or
No.
hyperlinks or anything? Yeah,
No, there's not a playlist.
I really love that because it turned me on to so many different things, especially this one, the first one. So the first one, you break it down into it's psychedelic unknowns, mad geniuses, punk pioneers, lo-fi mavericks. There's everything from sort of overlooked originators, you know, the Collins kids, Wanda Jackson, lost British invaders. This is the book that got me. I had no idea about the creation. This is how I found out about the creation. Garage bands, you know, the recluses like Syd Barrett and Roky Erickson. Krautrock, which is a favorite genre of mine, and so on and so forth. So let's talk a little bit about these two books. And, you know, there was really no coverage at that point, in-depth stuff about these particular kinds of artists, really, before you did these, correct?
There was some, not nearly as much as there is today, which is ironic because when I did that book, I was much closer in time to when those artists were active. But I had done some work with that publisher, who's no longer around, on the physical editions of the All Music Guide, which is also no longer around. It's been a long
Right.
time.
No.
And they said, if you have ideas for books of your own, let us know. And my criteria, I don't want to make this sound too noble. It wasn't, what's going to be the book that's going to sell the most that I do? Should I do a book on Metallica or something like that? Not that I ever would do one. And I thought, well, what's the book I would be most interested in doing, which would also enable me to interview a lot of these people and get these stories? That's Although I like writing, I like the process involved in writing. That is the most interesting part of doing books for me, is
Right.
finding out these stories and talking to the people. And 1998, although that's like 20 to 30 years after most of the people in the book were in their primes, a lot more of them obviously were still alive.
Yeah.
So quite a few of them were not alive or accessible, but I was able to get a hold of a lot, or in some cases, if I couldn't get a hold of them, managed to talk to somebody who had worked with them pretty closely.
Right.
And also, I didn't spell this out with the publisher, but I felt like I want to pick exactly who
Right.
I want to pick the artist that I am curious about, not so much, well, I know that people are really interested in the Seeds or somebody like that, but I'm not a big fan of them.
Right.
So they very much reflect my interests, tastes, and curiosity. Even in some cases where I'm not a huge fan of the music, but I thought the story must be so interesting, like Crass, the anarchist punk band. So I
Well,
picked
I
so.
loved this. The Mystic Tide was fantastic. You know, just to give people a let's just conclude with you telling the story of these guys, and kind of they were almost like a proto television in a way, I guess.
They're the most obscure act in that book, I think, still. And I found out about them because around 1984, a French label put out a compilation where it was like four of their singles were on one side, the other side was somebody else, and they didn't have the rights to do that. They just sort of took the sound for these singles and put them out, figuring no one's going to raise trouble over something that's so niche. And I thought that was really, really good. Then a few years later, someone I know who's I've been friendly with for a while put out those songs and a few others on a compilation. That's how I found the guy who wrote the songs and was the guitarist, Joe Dacco. Who's still living in New York State. He's passed away since then. And he had never been interviewed. It's pretty rare to find someone who's never excuse me, been
Yeah.
interviewed at this stage. I think that the guy who did the CE just asked him a few basic questions, but it didn't really tell you much about them. It was also interesting because he seemed just kind of stunned that people would be interested in all these years, but he did open up and gave me some reasonable details about what he and the group were doing. And they never came, it wasn't like, oh, that like the Music Machine is in the book. They had one big hit, but they didn't have the success that they deserved. Or Nick Drake, he didn't sell many records, but he got a huge cult following afterward.
Right.
But a whole album of their material with extensive liner notes, as much as could be found out, just came out last year
Oh,
on
wow. Let's
LP.
check that
So
out.
it's still, if music is good enough, my feeling is people will still want to hear it. It's not like, well, that was just so long ago. Who cares about that? Which is an attitude that I've come across. You probably have too
Right. And I
from
find
your
too
work.
that I find that that younger, you know, the new generation, it just delights in kind of throwing into the boomer generation, this was great and you missed it, and we're gonna like elevate it. So I think that's actually very healthy for both, you know, both the younger audience and then, you know, the older audience that might have missed something like this. 'Cause that was the, there's so many, I can't recommend this book highly enough. And this book is a little more in depth on each artist, but you know, for people who really want to discover, you know, the history of music and the sort of the, you know, very talented and maybe some unknown folks or not well enough known folks, that should deserve bigger attention and who influence the bigger, more mainstream artists or at least more successful artists that you kind of know about. So that's it. I thank you for joining me. I can't wait to see, hear, and read your Velvet Underground book. And I suggest everybody go wherever they can, Amazon or wherever, to pick up, you know, these books and to pick up the Tom Wilson book. So thanks so much, Richie, for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Okay, cool.
forsake him. Strive, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Down he sins of street life fancies. Chase the costumes she shall wear. Ermine furs adorn imperious. Severin, Severin awaits you there. Kiss the boot of shiny, shiny leather. Shiny leather in the dark. Tongue the thongs, the belt that does await you. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Severin, speak so slightly. Severin, down on your bended knee. Taste the whip in love not given lightly.